Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CCXIV, Aurelian, Restorer of the Age. Aurelian had seen off Vandals, Goths, and conquered the forces of Zenobia to reclaim the East. But to the west lies the Gallic Empire, once firm territory of Rome, awaiting his attention. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
The Gallic Empire, as we call it today, has been going strong since 260, when it emerged in the aftermath of Valerian's capture. So it originally encompassed Gaul, Britain, and Spain. At some point, probably in the reign of Claudius Gothicus, Spain rejoined the Central Empire. We don't know the reasons for this. We can only tell the change based on inscriptions and whether they honour the emperors in the Gallic Empire or the Central Empire. But still, controlling Gaul and Britain is a major thorn in the side of Aurelian.
Okay, and they are legitimately viewing themselves as their own empire, their own version of the Roman Empire in their own right, aren't they?
That's right. They have the full imperial titles, Imperator Caesar Augustus, etc. You know, they have consulships that are held both by emperors and by Gallic senators. So they have their own senate as well. They mint coins in which the emperors are depicted just like emperors in the Central Empire. So they're not a breakaway empire in the sense that they want to be something completely separate. One word that has been used to describe them is loyalist, like they still want to be Roman, but they want to be Roman on their own.
Oh, okay. You guys aren't Roman enough for us.
Yes, yes, exactly. Exactly.
Okay, so the emperor then at the moment of the Western Empire is Tetricus.
Yes, that's right. So Postumus established the empire, but then he was murdered and there was a bit of a turnover of emperors, and Victorinus, who ruled until 271, was murdered by his soldiers. But his mother, Victorinus's mother, Victoria, took action and actually chose the next successor, Gaius Pius Esuvius Tetricus, who was the governor of Aquitania, which is a province in southern Gaul. So he was already part of the regime of the Gallic Empire. And it's really interesting, I wish we had better sources for this period, how Victoria played this role in actually giving the empire to Tetricus. But certainly because Aurelian was so occupied elsewhere, by the time we get to 274, Tetricus is still in control of Gaul and Britain. He even has a son, Tetricus II, who he made Caesar in 273. So by all accounts, they see a long future ahead of them.
But there is not a long future ahead of him.
No, because Aurelian has other plans. So Aurelian is back in Rome in the winter of 273, 274. Again, this is the Northern Hemisphere winter, so December, January. And Tetricus and defeating the Gallic Empire is the next cab off the rank, really, because then he can genuinely claim to have restored the world. He may have taken comfort from the fact that all was not well in the Gallic Empire. A certain Faustinus, who was governor of Belgica, staged a rebellion against Tetricus in Trier, which was a major city, you know, it had a mint. So there was uncertainty and upheaval which he could take advantage of.
Mm. So where does he move troops? So this happens in 274.
Yeah, so in the spring, you know, you notice that, you know, he always waits out the winter and then goes in the spring. Yeah, very sensible. Crosses the Alps. He retakes Lugdunum, modern-day Lyon, and then moves north to Trier, where Tetricus is based. And the forces of Aurelian Tetricus meet in battle at the Catalanian Fields. This is northern Gaul, now near the modern town of Chalons-sur-Champagne. What happened next, or what happened in the course of the battle, is the subject of different accounts. As always, we're having to unpick different traditions here. So one story is that Tetricus actually betrayed his troops and handed himself over to Aurelian before the battle. Mm. So this is the version in the Historia Augusta's Life of Aurelian, but it's not unique to the Historia Augusta. So Eutropius, who's writing in the late 4th century, book 9, chapter 13, has the same story. And Eutropius says, and I quote, "Tetricus himself, indeed, betraying his own army, whose constant mutinies he was unable to bear, had even by secret letters entreated Aurelian to march against him, using, amongst other solicitations, the verse of Virgil, 'Unconquered hero, free me from these ills.'" The idea that there's military instability in Gaul is certainly plausible. The idea, however, that Tetricus betrayed his troops and actually invited Aurelian to invade Gaul is uncertain. So the line of Virgil comes from Book 6 of the Aeneid. It's spoken by Palinurus, who was Aeneas's helmsman as they sailed to Italy, but then died during the journey. So his sort of sacrifice was seen to be necessary for Aeneas to make it to Italy. And in Book 6, Palinurus meets Aeneas again in the underworld, implores Aeneas to save him, to rescue him, calls him Invicte, so unconquered one, and Invictus is a title that is, you know, given to Roman emperors. So I'm not sure how far we can actually believe that Tetricus invited Aurelian into Italy. In another version from Aurelius Victor on the Caesars, chapter 35, Tetricus approaches Aurelian directly before the battle and surrenders. But the battle still took place, which makes it, I think, unlikely that Tetricus did hand himself over, because why would there be need for a battle?
One in which you're essentially massacring Romans.
Yes, you're massacring your own troops, you're massacring Roman citizens on the side.
You're depleting potential soldiers from your side.
Yes, exactly. And it doesn't necessarily make Aurelian look that good to, you know, just slaughter these soldiers to make a point. It's really difficult to work out what really happened. It may be, you know, a blackening of Tetricus's character later by making him a weak-willed leader in comparison with the valiant Aurelian. We don't know. But, you know, Tetricus does survive, goes on to have a life of retirement, much like Zenobia. So maybe this was the price he had to pay.
So Tetricus is taken in battle, and this is the very brief war which constituted reconquering the West.
Yes, it all seems to come down to one battle, essentially. Yeah. Obviously, Aurelian did take Lugdunum and things like that, but the way in which our sources presented it is just like, this is the moment, and presumably, you know, there's no fighting in Britain, and Britain just goes over as well when Tetricus surrenders.
There's a slight chance that Britain didn't realise that anything had changed.
Well, yes, yes, that is a possibility that as well. I mean, one thing that did change, interestingly, so we know that in the Gallic Empire, senators were still appointed to command armies, where that had stopped in the Central Empire under Gallienus. So it is now only with the recovery of Britain and Gaul that once again senators lose the right to command troops there and replaced by equestrians. So that is one change they would have noticed, at least in the upper echelons of the administration.
So what happens to Tetricus then? Is this somebody that Aurelian treats as a foreign enemy? Is this triumph worthy?
It is triumph worthy, but like Zenobia, he escapes with his life. So the way the historian Augusta puts it is that there's a joint triumph in 274 over Palmyra and over the Gauls.
Considering how much he had to do and how long it takes to plan a triumph, that wouldn't surprise me.
It is actually plausible that it happened together. I do actually agree with that, rather than the triumph for Zenobia in 273 and then Tetricus in 274.
Yeah.
I think it's plausible it was a double event. And the way the historian Augusta describes it as, you know, the reuniting of both East and West is convincing.
Mm.
So in the historian Augusta, Life of Aurelian 32.4, says, "And so Aurelian, now ruler over the entire world, having subdued both the East and the Gauls, victor in all lands, turned his march towards Rome, so that he might present to the gaze of the Romans a triumph over both Zenobia and Tetricus, that is, over both the East and the West."
Yeah. Interesting how much a triumph has changed, isn't it? It's no longer about conquering the enemy. It's, in this instance, it's reunifying the Roman territory.
And yes, no, there is a change. So, for example, you know, when Augustus defeated both Mark Antony and Cleopatra, it had to be presented as a victory over Egypt. That was the foreign queen that had seduced a Roman citizen. A shift we now find from the 3rd century onwards, and then particularly in the 4th, is it becomes acceptable to stage triumphs over civil war enemies.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's perfectly fine.
But despite that, I'm getting the impression that what we do know about the triumph, or what we're told about the triumph, is that Tetrarchus was presented as a foreigner.
Yes. So, well, according to Historia Augusta, he was paraded in a scarlet cloak, yellow tunic, and Gallic trousers. So, you know, only barbarians wear trousers. Romans wear tunics and togas. So
sure. Okay. Yep.
Definitely foreign garb.
A fashion faux pas.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Exactly. Well, it marked you out as strange. That was very important. And both were pardoned, both Tetrarchus and his son. Tetrarchus was made governor of Lucania, a region of southern Italy.
So not just pardoned, but given a position.
Exactly. Wow. Exactly. And this is, you know, in several sources, so it's completely believable. In the Epitome de Caesaribus, the epitome on the lives of the Caesars, Aurelian jokes that it was actually better to govern part of Italy than to rule beyond the Alps.
Yeah, sure. I'm sure they would have loved that beyond the Alps.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yes.
Great. That's quite merciful of him.
Yeah, well, it seems to be what he wanted to do with both Zenobia and Tetrarchus was to display them in the parade, but then not to kill them. Because normally at the end of a triumph, you kill the foreign enemy.
Yes.
That they're sacrificed to Jupiter. So not to do this, you know, is a sign of mercy for an emperor who does have, you know, a reputation for being unmerciful.
Yeah. It's also not making a martyr out of them.
Yes, that is true, yes.
Which you don't want to give, you know, the Palmyrans another excuse to kick off.
No, nor the Gauls either.
Yeah, yeah. So we don't really know a lot about the process of reintegration then.
Mm.
You said that the change of who's commanding, whether it's senator or just a general. But beyond that, reintegration just happened quite smoothly?
Well, we can only tell from inscriptional evidence, and of course that presents a rather artificial version because it just tells us what happened rather than people's reactions to it. So, for example, we know there were milestones in Gaul, in Gallia Narbonensis, that hail Aurelian as the restorer of the Gallic provinces. But this, of course, you know, could be set up by members of his own administration. We do know that some officials who had served in the Gallic administration now continued to serve in, you know, the reunited empire. So there's an Acephalus career inscription from Rome, and that, so it doesn't have a head. We don't know the name of the person, but they do seem to have been procurator of the mint in Trier before going on to Rome. And this is quite important because the mint at Trier only operates in the 3rd century under the Gallic Empire.
Okay,
Then it's closed and the minting takes place at Lugdunum. So there is a mint again later in late antiquity, but this inscription dates from the 3rd century.
So not only do you get the acknowledgement of the previous career path,
yeah,
but you get a reintegration into the normal Roman career elites. So, yeah.
That's right, that's right. One other interesting thing, we're looking at the Gallic Empire, is that inscriptions for equestrian commanders, so commander of cavalry units or auxiliaries, their name suggests local Gallic or British origin. So rather than people being drawn from across the empire to serve in these posts, they're actually promoted from local regions, and that kind of locality is a really interesting twist on career paths in this period.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing in terms of the impact of the Gallic Empire is that there's a sense from the 3rd century onwards that there needs to be an emperor in Gaul. There's a 4th century text. It's anonymous. It's called On the Description of the Entire World. And when it goes through Gaul, it says, Gaul always needs an emperor.
Mm.
And so really from the late 3rd century onwards, so from the late 280s, for about 100 years, the late 4th century, there is always a Caesar Augustus based in Gaul, and particularly close to the Rhine frontier. And this reflects an expectation by the Gallic people that there be an emperor based there to protect their frontiers, and then this also stops them from raising their own in opposition to a central emperor.
Timeline-wise, we're not far away from that.
We're 274 now. So, yeah, in about 15 years, there is basically going to be an Augustus and or a Caesar based in Gaul for the next 100 years.
Yeah.
So I think that is a really important impact. And local elites become accustomed to having an emperor close by. They're accustomed to forming part of his court. They're accustomed to holding office in Gaul or Britain without having to travel across the empire. Again, this is a feature of the later Roman Empire, that you do get these sort of provincial clusters that become really important because there's an emperor in the region.
So we've spoken about Aurelian in the terms of him being a restorer. How important was that to his propaganda that he's restored the Roman Empire and he's now ruling over an empire that hasn't been seen for years, for decades really, with the slight footnote that he's gotten rid of one Dacian province.
Yeah, he's got rid of Dacia across the Danube and recreated it on the other side. Yes, so this is clearly a moment of triumph for Aurelian. So in 274, his wife, Ulpia Severina, is given the title of Augusta. She appears on coins. This is a milestone because we know very little about her, but the fact that she's given this title then suggests it was part of the celebrations. We know that speeches of praise, panegyrics, were given in honour of Aurelian. So Callinicus of Petra, who you might remember was at Zenobia's court, writes a panegyric entitled On the Restoration of the World.
Someone else got spared.
Yes, yeah, no, yes, exactly, you know, he was the historian of Alexandria. He also wrote a panegyric on the great king, which we think was written about Aurelian, because it contained no reference to the emperor's family background because he was of such obscure birth. So this is something we find from this period onwards, because we have emperors rising from the ranks of the soldiers. You know, they're usually not equestrians by birth. They gain equestrian rank in the course of their career. They don't have, you know, illustrious lineage to refer to. So instead, Aurelian's public image concentrates on how he restored the empire, but also his association with the gods because of that. So coins produced at the mint of Serdica have the legend Imp Deo et Domino. So this would be to the emperor, god and lord. And one has Imp Deo et Domino Nato Aureliano. So to Emperor Aurelian, born Lord and God. So just think of the, you know, furor when Domitian wanted to be called Dominus Deus back in the first century AD. Here we find Aurelian's coinage proclaiming that he was born to this. This was his destiny. And this was a way to overcome their humble background, to say really it's their innate virtues that have them chosen by the gods. We have an anecdote which we don't know the time period of it, so we can't place it precisely, but it does shed light on this attitude of Aurelian. And this comes from our good old friend, the anonymous continuator of Cassius Dio, fragment 10.6. And in this, it says, Aurelian once learned of a military mutiny and said that the troops were mistaken if they supposed that the fates of the emperors were in their hands. For he said that God had bestowed the purple, and this he displayed in his right hand, and had totally determined the duration of his reign. And he did not depart before he had punished about 50 instigators of the revolt. So you can't do anything to me because I've received this from the gods.
Yes, interesting as well that they've determined the duration of his reign.
Yes, yes. So however long I reign, it's in the lap of the gods. His coins also promote ideas of restoration and pacification. They feature legends such as Peccator Orbis, the pacifier of the world, Restitutor Orbis, the restorer of the world, and Restitutor Cycle, the restorer of the age. Now, what's really interesting is this excessive, extravagant language is also found in inscriptions. Now, some of these inscriptions are erected by members of the imperial administration. Some of them are by provincial communities. But what we do find throughout all these texts is an extravagant, inflated language, which reflects that they're honouring Aurelian for his achievements. So in 274, the urban prefect of Rome, Virius Orphetus, erected a statue of Aurelian in the city that said he was restorer of the world, the strongest and most victorious princeps. So this gives him epithets Fortissimus and Victoriosissimus. So really, you know, flowery, superlative language there. We find a governor in Moesia describing Aurelian as restorer of the fatherland, whereas the community of Brixia in North Italy said he was the mighty Augustus, greatest prince, most valiant emperor, preserver of the world. And sometimes these epithets are built up one after another. So in North Africa, in milestones there, he's eternal, most victorious, most indulgent. And we also find other new epithets like Pacatissimus, the most pacifying emperor. So these are results of individuals and state officials wanting to reflect this extravagant language. Eternal imperator, perpetuous imperator is found throughout the empire as well as part of this explosion of flattery. And the historian David Potter has suggested that this language has parallel with that which we commonly find in panegyrics. So it could have been inspired by speeches in praise of Aurelian that were delivered throughout the empire.
So I wonder how he's going to live up to his own propaganda at this point. If you've done this in, you know, 5 short years of reign, what's going to be done for the rest of your life?
Well, that does pose a challenge. Yes, exactly. One story we do find is that he was perhaps planning a Persian campaign at the end of his life, because, you know, that would outstrip his achievements about Palmyra. The evidence is uncertain, but we know, you know, there are further campaigns to protect the frontiers. But yes, certainly, once you've restored the world, where do you go from there?
But this as well, it's important to keep in mind, is all happening within 274. You're essentially got all this propaganda coming out as a connection to this one great achievement that you've had.
Yes.
One great achievement in a few parts, sure. But this can just be all seen as part of the triumph, the celebration, the veneration that you've got a united Roman Empire again.
Yes, exactly. We're all together. We're all restored. We're united under this most victorious emperor.
That was Associate Professor Caelan Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on any podcasting platform you're inclined to visit. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and I realise that I have previously promoted this podcast on Twitter, but Twitter no longer exists, so hey, if you want to get in touch, send Emperors of Rome an email. We're at emperorspodcast@gmail.com. This podcast has been produced at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.